Hi, everyone. I'm Harris Cohen, an attorney in Los Angeles, and we are lucky today to have Nikki Cohen here to give us valuable information. Nikki is an associate at Buckhalter in the commercial finance department of its Los Angeles office. While Nikki is an attorney, she is not your attorney. That is, unless you are a client of Buckhalter, in which case, she may be your attorney. In any event, this podcast is not legal advice on the topics covered, and if you seek legal advice on any of these topics concerning any particular facts or circumstances, feel free to contact Nikki. Today's podcast is for entertainment purposes only, so if you find arbitration clauses to be entertaining, you are in the right place. Without further ado, let's dive in. How are you, Nikki?
I'm doing great. So what case are we discussing today?
Well, today we're going to discuss the case of Ramirez versus Charter Communications. And that is a July 14th, 2024 case by the California Supreme Court. So why don't we start with you tell us what were the facts of that case?
Charter has nearly 100,000 employees throughout the U.S. Ms. Ramirez was hired in July of 2019 and entered into an employment agreement with Charter. Shortly thereafter, she was fired in 2020, so not a very long stint there. She then filed a lawsuit against Charter and raised various employment claims, including retaliation under the Fair Employment and Housing Act, which we will now call the FEHA for short. Relying on Charter's employment agreement, Charter moved to compel arbitration and to recover attorney's fees. In terms of the procedural history, the trial court found that this agreement was one of adhesion because it was required as a condition of employment, and they found that the agreement was unconscionable. The Court of Appeal affirmed the denial of Charter's motion to compel arbitration.
Okay, so you mentioned unconscionability. What exactly is that?
So generally, unconscionability has both procedural and substantive elements. In short, procedural unconscionability has to do with unequal bargaining power. Substantive has to do with the substance of the agreement, which talks about it being overly harsh, unduly oppressive, things of that nature. Both procedural and substantive unconscionability must be present, meaning you need both. However, they don't have to be equal.
Well, if they don't have to be equal, then what kind of a test is it to know whether you have enough unconscionability?
It's going to be a sliding scale. So the more you have of one, means the less you need of the other in order to meet the standard. The party resisting enforcement of an arbitration agreement has a burden to establish unconscionability.
You mentioned procedural unconscionability generally, but let's dive in a little deeper. What can you tell us about it?
Sure. So the court discusses that contracts of adhesion have a degree of procedural unconscionability. Generally, contracts of adhesion are contracts between parties with unequal bargaining power. Like here, for instance, Charter, a huge company, has much more bargaining power than little old Miss Ramirez, who's entering into this employment agreement. Other examples could be bank depositor contracts and brokerage firm account holder contracts. These types of contracts are typically non-negotiable and controlled by the stronger party. This may not be present for contracts where two large banks or an indispensable employee and his or her employer are entering into an agreement. But in this instance, the court found that this was a contract of adhesion and considered procedurally unconscionable.
Now, when you mentioned little old Ms. Ramirez, you don't really know whether she was little or old. Is that right?
That is true. I do not know her physical features and therefore could not really speculate as to what she's like.
Okay, so she could be tall, young Ms. Ramirez.
Very true. Okay. That is definitely possible.
All right, now you mentioned substantive unconscionability and gave us a quick outline. Can you go a little deeper into what that means?
Sure, slightly. So the court uses terms such as overly harsh, unduly oppressive, unreasonably favorable when they're discussing substantive unconscionability. Ultimately, what we need to determine is whether the terms of a contract are sufficiently unfair in view of all relevant circumstances that a court should withhold enforcement.
Terms like unduly harsh or unreasonably favorable, those sound a little bit amorphous, like it's tough to have a bright line or know exactly where a contract is just harsh enough, but not overly harsh. How do you figure that out?
Now, they could pull from any different
sources. So all you can really do in this type of a circumstance is read all the cases where terms are found to be unconscionable and sometimes not unconscionable, and just compare them to the terms of the contract you're analyzing.
Exactly.
What types of clauses did the court analyze regarding substantive unconscionability?
The court discussed four. The first one was a lack of mutuality in covered and excluded claims. The second was shortened filing time limits. The third was limits on discovery. And the fourth was award of interim attorney's fees.
Let's break these up. Why don't we first dig into the lack of mutuality of covered and uncovered claims? Tell us about that.
So big picture is the question, what claims are covered or excluded from the arbitration clause to determine whether there was a lack of mutuality? Mutuality is a term of art, and therefore there are some nuances which we're going to discuss a little bit later. Unless there's a reasonable justification for one-sidedness based on business realities, I'm using air quotes here, all claims arising from the transaction or occurrence should be either covered or excluded under the arbitration clause. So can you think of any business reality that would apply when it comes to covered and excluded claims?
Well, I can think of a couple. First of all, unlawful detainer claims, at least in California, there's case law providing that in certain circumstances, they cannot be arbitrated. And therefore, that would be one circumstance for excluding certain unlawful detainer claims. Also, if you were a national company and you were drafting a national contract that's going to be used in every state, there may be some types of claims that are either required to be arbitrated or prohibited from being arbitrated. And therefore, in a national contract, you would want to, of course, follow the law in the most restrictive state. And therefore, in the other states, there may be arguments that it's one-sided, but the business reality is it's a national contract, and that would be a basis for that provision. So with respect to those types of scenarios or other scenarios, what did the court have to say in this case?
So the parties are free to contract for asymmetrical remedies in arbitration clauses. The doctrine of unconscionability limits the extent to which a stronger party may, through a contract of adhesion, impose the arbitration forum on the weaker party without accepting that forum for itself. So with that being said, in the absence of justification, the court is going to assume that the specific term of the agreement is unconscionable. Therefore, practitioners who are drafting arbitration clauses should be aware of this presumption. So the best course of action is going to be what's good for the goose is good for the gander. In this case, there were various claims that were covered or excluded by the arbitration clause. The court found that the covered claims were claims that would mostly be brought by an employee, whereas important claims that were most likely to be brought by the employer were going to be considered excluded claims. For example, the arbitration clause excludes any requests for injunctive relief, including one for a permanent injunction related to unfair competition or unauthorized use of trade secrets or confidential information. These types of claims are more likely to be initiated by charter and the protection provided by the exclusion. Additionally, the employer argued that the exclusion for the employee of workers' comp and unemployment insurance claims benefited employees. However, the court found that these exclusions are illusory as they are excluded from arbitration by law. So for practitioners drafting arbitration clauses, you may want to consider covering IP property or IP related claims and refrain from excluding any claims that would already be excluded by law since they wouldn't enhance your argument. The court further discussed that the presence of a modicum of bilaterality will not save a clause that is, in practical effect, unjustifiably one-sided. For example, when deciding whether a certain category of claims should either be covered or excluded, if you're going to exclude your category of claims and require the other party's same category of claims be subject to arbitration, you better have a business justification, otherwise the likelihood of the clause being found to be substantively unconscionable will increase.
Okay, let's move on to the next topic, that is shortened filing time limits. What did the court have to say about the agreement that shortened the filing time limits?
The issue in this case is that the arbitration agreement required the employee to file her claim within the time limit for filing an administrative claim with an agency or other administrative body. Here, the court focused on the FEHA claim. While the statute of limitations at the time Ms. Ramirez filed her claim could be as long as 3 years, Under the agreement, it required that any such claim would be filed within 1 year, which would be the applicable deadline for the filing the administrative claim. The court found that the statutory rights under the FEHA were significant employee rights and that shortening the time for filing a claim to vindicate those rights had an element of substantive unconscionability. Further, because the FEHA claims are initiated by filing a claim with the Department of Fair Employment and Housing, which may investigate the employee claim and then issue a right to sue letter, the arbitration agreement's deadline may expire before the department had a reasonable opportunity to conclude its investigation. Therefore, the court found that the shortened time limitation for filing a claim was substantively unconscionable.
So really what you're saying then is that anytime you want to shorten the time for filing a claim in arbitration, you're really gambling. You're taking this risk. The risk being that if you're wrong, even that one limitation could cause the entire arbitration provision to be thrown out because it's substantively unconscionable.
Exactly. Practitioners drafting arbitration clauses outside of the context of employment agreements should therefore be particularly sensitive to shortening filing deadlines when the rights of the other party may be subject to public policy protections. Further, practitioners should bear in mind that the court's ability to scrutinize shortening filing deadlines is a simple numerical test and not the type of qualitative test that may be applied to other issues.
The next clause that the court analyzed was the limitation on discovery. What did the court have to say about that?
The court analyzed under the agreement that discovery was limited to up to 4 depositions, 20 interrogatories, including subparts, and 5 requests for documents. The court analyzed these limitations at the time the contract was formed and rejected the line of reasoning that discovery limitations are going to be analyzed post-contract formation.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the court looks at this issue at the time you sign the contract to see whether, in anticipation of what claims might be made, whether or not that's reasonable, rather than later looking at what claims are actually made to determine whether that initial estimate of what discovery should be was reasonable under the circumstances. Is that right?
That's right. So when the court analyzed the factors, they analyzed things like what types of claims are covered by the agreement, the amount of discovery allowed, the degree to which that amount may differ from the amount available in conventional litigation, any asymmetries between the parties with regard to discovery, and the arbitrator's ultimate authority to order additional discovery. The clause in question wasn't clear as to whether the arbitrator had the authority to grant additional discovery, so the court concluded that the arbitrator had the authority to order additional discovery if the arbitrator determined that the action is necessary to allow fair arbitration of the claim.
So did the court find that it was conscionable or unconscionable?
They found that it was not conscionable. I mean, not unconscionable.
Okay. So if you were trying to avoid this issue at all, you didn't even want the court to have to reach it, how would you draft a clause regarding discovery?
If you want to play it safe, you should expressly allow all discovery available in a court action. However, if you want to gamble a little and restrict discovery, I would lay out what you think is a reasonable limit on discovery, include a clause within your arbitration provision that states that at the time the parties are entering into the contract, both parties agree that this is considered a reasonable restriction on discovery. And then I would also give the arbitrator the ultimate authority to expand discovery if necessary, in the interest of allowing fair arbitration of the claim.
The next clause analyzed by the court was the award of interim attorney's fees. What did the court have to say about that, Nikki?
The section of the opinion was limited to the attorney's fees clause within the arbitration provision solely with respect to a FEHA claim. The court stressed the asymmetric attorney's fees rule for FEHA claims that only permits an employee or an employer to recover attorney's fees if the employee's claim is 1, frivolous, 2, unreasonable, or groundless when brought. The court expressed particular concern for the potential scenario when employee challenges a motion to compel arbitration and the court finds that the arbitration provision has some unconscionable clause or clauses, and yet grants the motion to compel arbitration. In this circumstance, If the prevailing party were able to receive attorney's fees, it would have not necessarily have satisfied the requirement to prove that the opposition to its motion was frivolous, unreasonable, or groundless. For practitioners drafting an attorney's fees clause within an arbitration provision, it would be prudent to expressly exclude FIHA claims from such clause or limit the right to recover attorney's fees when the court finds the opposition to the motion was frivolous, unreasonable, or groundless when brought. Practitioners should also research if there are any other types of claims that may limit attorney's fees to circumstances where a court must make specific findings or place any other limitation or bar to the recovery of attorney's fees.
Wow. So this seems like there could be a lot of pitfalls with respect to attorney's fees clauses, because not only do you have this FIHA issue, but potentially there's any statute where there are limitations on the recovery of attorney's fees that aren't standard under the civil code for the recovery of attorney's fees. You're at risk for every one of those. Is that right?
Definitely set yourself up for some potential issues depending on whether there may be restrictions on attorney's fees that you don't know about, and it could lead to negative consequences.
Now that we've gone through all of the unconscionable clauses or the analysis of those, the court also dealt with the issue of severance. What did the court have to say about severance?
Let's dive into severance a bit further, which finds its roots in Civil Code Section 1670.5. If a contractual claim is found to be unconscionable, the court may, in its discretion, A, refuse to enforce the agreement, B, sever any unconscionable clause, or C, limit the application of any clause to avoid unconscionable results. There is strong legislative and judicial preference to sever the unconscionable term and enforce the balance of the agreement. The court quoted from Armendariz confirming that choice A, which is refusing to enforce a contract, should be used sparingly and only when the agreement is permeated by unconscionability. One key issue is whether the court can salvage the arbitration provision by severing or restricting clauses, as it's not permitted to rewrite the parties' agreements or, as a court stated, cure it through reformation or augmentation. Critically, the court clarified that it wasn't imposing or setting a numerical bright line rule. So one unconscionable term may be sufficient to refuse to enforce the agreement, or it may be three or four unconscionable terms.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that this is perhaps the biggest gamble when drafting, in that any one clause can cause your whole provision to be unconscionable, or many may not cause it to be unconscionable. You don't know in advance. And the worst thing you could do is push the envelope and then count on the court to sever the unconscionable clauses. Because if it chooses not to, everything is just blown and now you're back to superior court.
Precisely. So the appropriate inquiry is qualitative based on a totality of the circumstances. And the question really that needs to be answered is whether the central purpose of the contract is tainted with illegality. If so, it can't be cured. If severance or restriction is possible, that's a preferred course for provisions that are collateral to the agreement's main purpose. That isn't the end of the inquiry. Just because a court can sever or restrict and cure doesn't mean it should do so. The court should consider whether unconscionability should be cured because the interests of justice would be furthered by such actions. This inquiry focuses on whether enforcement after severance or restriction would condone an illegal scheme, and whether the defects indicate that the stronger party engaged in a systematic effort to impose arbitration on the weaker party to secure a forum that works to the stronger party's advantage. Without identifying a bright line test, the court did quote another case stating that the more unconscionable provisions, the less likely severance is going to be the appropriate remedy. This was really to discourage the gambling aspect that you mentioned above, of drafting all unconscionable provisions and letting the court sever whatever it needs to in order to enforce the agreement. The court does not encourage this type of drafting.
So this is one of those few cases where not only does the court analyze the facts and the law, but it seemed to give a practitioner a hint and said, don't count on us. Do your own work.
Exactly. The court did note that if there is a severance clause, the court should take that into account as an expression of the party's intent. Thus, it's clear that all arbitration clauses should definitely have a severance clause expressing the party's desire for enforcement of the arbitration provision. It also seems clear that the more questionable clauses an arbitration provision contains, the less likely the court's going to be willing to enforce the remainder of the arbitration provision.
Nikki, can't this be solved by just having the Federal Arbitration Act govern the arbitration agreement?
Glad you asked. The answer is no. The court explained that the Federal Arbitration Act permits courts to declare arbitration agreements to be unenforceable on the same grounds as other contracts, including unconscionability.
So there is no end result here from that standpoint. But what about in the overall picture? What did the court end up deciding? Was the provision in total unconscionable or conscionable?
So, the answer is, we don't know. The Supreme Court reversed the Court of Appeals and remanded for further proceedings in the trial court consistent with their decisions. So we may not be done with this depending on whether the new trial court's opinion is appealed. Until next time.
So that's where we're going to leave it for today?
Yeah, I guess so.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.